This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. The snow and rain make it impossible to actually do a whole lot in your yard or garden right now. But in a few weeks, spring will be more than a date on the calendar. Then it will be possible to do all the things that you know have to be done and to implement the plans that you've made. I'm joined today by Horticulture Extension Agent in Campbell County, Sarah Stoltz. Also, David Kester, who is the County Extension Agent for Horticulture in Boone County. So we've got a lot of Northern Kentucky covered here. And Community Garden Manager for Turner Farm, Joshua Jones. If you'd like to join the conversation, please call us at 513-419-7100 or email talk at WVXU. Welcome to Cincinnati Edition. You all have been here many more times than I have, and so you'll carry me through this because I don't know a whole lot. So
we'll do our best.
Okay, but I used to be a greenskeeper on golf courses, so back when I was in high school and college. So I actually love cutting grass. But anyway, let's just begin with lawns. There's a lot of damage that we're coming out of the winter with. I mean, I'm noticing that along sidewalks and the driveway where salt or melter got on it. And it seems like in the winter when it's so wet, if you get off that driveway, you really chew it up. So what needs to be done right now in terms of just repairing some winter damage? And I don't know, who wants to start? Sarah?
Sure. So luckily, with the snow that we've recently had, yes, there's salt and maybe some sled riding or, you know, rolling up some snowballs or, you know, making an igloo or whatnot. But, you know, with the rain and moisture, that takes the salt and it washes it away, too. So if you're thinking about any type of burn, that's in the benefit of the moisture and the rain that we're blessed with to have this week. So that's great. I would not come back anytime soon and add any fertilizer right now. You would really want to do that in the fall of the year. Because right now what we probably will start seeing, especially with these warmer days that we're having, are some of our winter annual weeds coming up. So if you fertilize, you're actually fertilizing the lawn, the desirable plant that you would like, and you're also fertilizing the weeds. So just be, you know, cautious about that. You know, if you wanted to put crabgrass herbicide down, you're about that time. It's about when forsythia is in bloom. So I've been seeing forsythia blooming. So you can do some spot treatments. But, you know, of course, you can reach out to the extension office for some publications. We have sustainable management practices for, you know, home lawns. So yeah, before you apply, just because it's fertilizer, and definitely don't apply more because that's not better, just be cautious. And, you know, I always recommend getting a soil test too, because, you know, the fertilizer bags, those three numbers, N, P, and K, N, nitrogen, then phosphorus and potassium. Most times we don't need phosphorus and potassium, and that becomes a pollutant in our drinking water. And so we had to be very cautious of that. And, you know, Campbell County residents, Boone County residents, and I believe Kenton County as well, you get free soil samples if you're a resident in that county. So,
and do you send them to the extension office?
Yeah, you just drop them off to the extension office. And we actually send those to the regulatory service in Lexington. So there's about a 2-week turnaround. And we always recommend getting those done, especially for your lawn and vegetables, in the fall of the year, because if there's any need to alter your soil pH or add something, especially if you're doing a renovation, you want to know that before you add any type of chemical or any other application. Okay. So definitely soil test before you do any of that.
Well, related to this is some of the things that you've been talking about in fertilizers and lawns. We have a question that was emailed into us as a result of promoting this yesterday, and it's from somebody by the name of Karen who lives in Mount Healthy. And I'll just read this. I hope you will make a pitch for lawn diversity and encourage folks to Eskew Lawn Fertilizing Services. White clover provides nitrogen and fertilizes the grass, as well as providing an important nectar source for honeybees throughout the summer. Dandelions are also the first major source of nectar for honeybees. Violets provide a touch of color. Now is the season for chemical lawn treatment companies to be proliferating and to be selling their services to people. And Karen in Mount Healthy obviously doesn't think this is a good idea. There's other things those weeds should – we should be tolerant of those weeds because they serve other purposes. Joshua, any?
Yeah, I am on the side of Karen on this. I know that we all like that lush, attractive, uniform green lawn, but as a beekeeper, and I think we've been hearing it in the news more and more, how the plight of our honeybees, how important that is to our local food systems and national food systems. I really can't stress enough that those dandelions that everybody really hates so bad and has been the target for herbicide companies to kind of villainize. That's the first food source oftentimes, major food source that bees get. And a lot of wild swarms as well as hives that beekeepers have, they really depend on those. So we as beekeepers can feed them, but wild swarms don't have that at their disposal. So without the what is considered to be a noxious weed in a lawn, those swarms won't survive. And to me, I think that it's best that we forego a picture-perfect lawn to really help out the ecosystem as a whole.
Well, David, what do you say to people, though, who say, I really can't stand – those things are weeds. They choke out other grasses.
Yeah, most people really like uniformity in their lawn, and having a mixture of dandelions and other things, it just doesn't get it for them. And if you're in a subdivision like that, you're almost compelled to do a little bit more. But we're trying to get people –
not legally, but social
exactly.
Social pressure.
Exactly,
right?
Yes. But we're trying to get people to fertilize in the fall. Don't rely as many – your lawnmower can be a very effective weed deterrent, and that you're trying to keep it cut. Your grass will regenerate by itself, and some of these broadleaf weeds, if you continue to cut the foliage and keep them from going to seed, you will eliminate them. So that's a great way to try to combat this a little bit as well. And, I love white clover, but it's still at my age. I love to also go out in my yard barefooted, and I can tell you, stepping on a bee that's gathering nectar off of a clover plant can be kind of painful, especially if you've got kids.
So there's multiple sides to this question. This is related sort of on the lawn side, and that is Jean. I'm not sure where she's from, but she sent us an email asking about no-mow areas that she has in her yard. She says she refers to them as dirt. and sort of what's the right approach to either sections in your lawn that you don't seem to be, whether because of shade or whatever, you're not able to really sustain a lawn, or maybe you don't want that uniform green grass all over. Mm-hmm. So when we talk about no-mow lawns, what's being talked about, and what can you share with us?
One of the things that I have found is that grass does not grow. Grass is a corn plant, and if you think of that, it's got to have full sun. And yeah, we have mixtures that are a little bit more shade tolerant, but they still will not grow in dense shade. And sometimes the best avenue is to either mulch that area, put a shade-loving ground cover underneath that setting, and just let that go. And those are better options a lot of times than to try to keep forcing lawn grass to grow where it really won't do well.
Sarah, when we say no mow, does that literally mean that the grass, you never have to mow it? Is it sort of grows to a certain height and that's it? If you're growing grass at all, I mean, there may be areas that you can't grow, and you do other things with, but.
So that's I'm going to answer that in two separate,
sure.
I guess, questions. So kind of low maintenance landscape. So if you want to transition an area, which I personally am doing that as well in our office. So trying to, what we also are educating is diversifying your landscape. So lawn is a monoculture, meaning one type of plant. So we're trying to diversify our plant selection in our landscape and also being sustainable. You know, some of our areas in our education garden are too moist, too shady, you know, too compacted with our clay soils. So we understand that environment and we have all these other little microclimates in our landscape, and we've identified that. So now we're choosing the right plant for the right site. And it may not be the fescue. So we're transitioning that into maybe a pollinator garden, or maybe it's just a wetlands area, or it may be a ground cover area, or a shade tolerant garden, like David said. And then the other side is the low-mow or no-mow. So we are trying to find that. And, you know, this Northern Kentucky, Greater Cincinnati area with our climate, I guess, hiccups that we have, you know, we're not warm enough for these zoysia grass or these warm season grasses. And we're too cool for some of these other grasses as well. So we're right in that transitional zone there for our hardiness on, if you look at the hardiness zone map. So with that, research is being done for these low-mow varieties. We did a quick search before coming today. We did not find any research data to show one variety is better than the other. And I really think that has to do with the area. So, you know, you may find information from out west, or you may find things, information from down south. But here in this zone, in this area, I just caution, make sure you choose the right plant for the right site. So I hope that answers that question.
Sure.
And to me, when it comes to that side yard that doesn't get a lot of full sun, there are options. You can do a vegetable garden. There are plenty of vegetables that love part shade, lettuces, radishes, things like that. So you can put that kind of space that that's kind of unsightly, you can put it to use in your kitchen. As well as I've seen, and this happens more out west, but rock landscapes are becoming really popular. A great way to conserve water. I know a lot of water goes to us watering our lawn, that being one of our most precious resources. I do really advocate for people trying to go to that rock landscape. They can be absolutely beautiful. And like Sarah said, there you can put the right plant in the right place in these rock landscapes that are very drought tolerant. And at that point, you just kind of set it and forget it, which is good if you can take off some of your maintenance around your house.
Gee, it sounds like maybe you don't want to cut grass all the time.
I don't have enough time in the day, unfortunately.
Okay. I know that for a lot of the advice is to plant trees in the fall. At least that's my understanding. I don't know if that's absolute or whatever. But what about the question of planting trees in the spring? What's your advice on that? How long can you do that? How long can you stretch out that planting season? And if you're going to plant, what are the things you really need to know about?
Well, you can really now the availability of trees and shrubs in pots has made it such that we can really plant later into the spring than we normally would. You're getting a plant that has a pretty intact root system. And if you do a good job planting it, make sure that you water it. You know, there really isn't any reason why if you care for it, that you can't be planting in June up until June. I wouldn't hesitate. And really with some of these container plantings, if you care for them, you can even do it all the way through. But if it's bald and burlap, I would probably try to get it in no later than April, May.
Okay, April, May if it's bald and burlap.
Right.
But if it's in a pot,
mm-hmm.
You could even stretch that a little bit farther.
I really think you can. And you can just, again, it's that first season. You've got to supplement water. If we don't get a good inch of water a week, then you need to be prepared to apply it.
And then in the actual planting, are there some do's and don'ts in terms of making sure that you plant it so that it has the best chance?
Absolutely. It's that old saying, if you buy a $20 plant, dig a $50 hole. And it just means that you're really trying to—
Oh, I didn't know that was an old saying. Well,
I didn't know that either.
Well, I like it. But you really need to prepare that site. I like, the recommendation is don't bring in a lot of amendments. However, if you've got a compacted clay area, you may have to get in some topsoil. And that, by that, I mean native topsoil, not the material that you buy in bags. And I just really like to – the wider the better on a planting hole. You know, no deeper than the root ball is currently, but the width is the critical point. And you want to loosen that soil so that those roots can break out into that area and move a little bit. And that's the critical thing.
Okay. Anybody want to add anything to that?
Fertilizer, I just caution, you know, it's recommended not to fertilize the first year. So, you know, once you transplant, those roots are already going through some transplant shock. And so just be mindful of that. If it's a flowering tree, don't expect it to flower its first year to be its showiest. So, because you really want those roots to anchor into the soil the first year or two. So it's recommended to fertilize the following year. Again, in the fall, similar to that of your turf.
Okay. We have a call from Robin who is taking us back a little bit on the question of weeds and whatever but that we were talking about. But Robin, what's your question?
Hi. Well, last year I put the black paper down or plastic down and went to the nursery and got some extensive mulch. And it's like a whole new set of weeds came out of the mulch. So I was wondering if taking that mulch up and putting rocks down, does that work better than mulch?
Well, oftentimes with the rock landscapes, they actually line those with some sort of landscape fabric, which is permeable to water but not permeable to weeds. So it would be a combination of the rocks and the mulch. And I don't know if you pulled that black plastic up, but if you were using landscape fabric underneath your mulch, it really just depends on what the aesthetic that you want. I think if you are having that weed issue, I'm not sure what kind of mulch you're using, but you want to make sure that's a source that doesn't have weed seed in it. Some mulches will have a little bit of soil in there, which would carry some weed seed with it. But I recommend putting the landscape fabric down on your bare soil, and then you can build up with either a purchased mulch or purchased rock, and that would definitely keep the weeds. It wouldn't probably not get rid of all of them, but it would reduce the pressure greatly.
The problem with adding mulch on top of the plastic is that the mulch is going to deteriorate and it's going to become soil and it's just going to be another perfect environment for weed seeds when they drop in that. They're going to root in that and they're going to keep going. I've never been crazy about the landscape fabric. I just would rather have a nice layer of mulch down there and just figure that I'm going to have to weed a little bit even though I've got mulch down.
Someone else asked, is it too early to mulch?
No. In addition to mulching, you know, I like to use the method of cardboard, you know, or newspaper, especially newspaper around vegetables, because that just adds another barrier and you're just repurposing a product that you have. And it biodegrades, unlike the fabric cloth that you buy, it does not biodegrade. And if you go in and you plant annuals or perennials, anytime there's a hole in that fabric, that just becomes a window of opportunity for weed seeds to germinate because the soil is a wonderful seed bank. And anytime you turn that soil or allow for that light to warm up that soil, germination is going to occur. And I also caution about using plastic. Remember, there is a difference between plastic and fabric. Plastic does not allow for your soil to breathe, and it actually will kill your soil and becomes dirt. So,
what's the difference here between soil and dirt?
So I actually had a perfect example a few years ago. I purchased a house and they used the plastic, and so it turned gray. Gray means non-living. There's no oxygen. And so microorganisms were beneficial organisms, non-existent. And so it was really, really wet and hard. And so and all that water was just running down. So, you know, that's not sustainable. Whereas the fabric, I don't like that, just similar to David. But if you have to use it, at least that allows for some water to go through in that. And so it doesn't kill your soil.
I had a professor tell me that dirt was the stuff you swept off the kitchen floor and soil was actually what you had in your backyard.
So.
Okay. Also related to trees, the question of pruning trees. When's the right time to do pruning of trees? And maybe this depends on the type of tree. We were mentioning flowering trees, fruit trees, hardwoods. Yeah. That all may be different.
You should take dead or problem limbs out of a tree at any time of year that they're there. But right now is an excellent time to be pruning landscape trees, fruit trees, those kind of things. The one thing you want to avoid are any of the shrubs that bloom at this time of year or will be blooming soon, because you prune them now, you're taking off this year's bloom. So you don't want to do that. But really, this is a good time to do it. You can see the structural parts of the tree, and if there's crossing limbs or just bad angled limbs, those should be removed now.
General rule of thumb. Of course, there's always exceptions to the rule, and there's also a publication about this. But a tree or shrub that blooms before June 1st blooms on last year's growth. So if you prune, like David said, you're pruning off the flower buds. But if it blooms after June 1st, that blooms on current season growth. So, you then prune that in the fall. So hopefully that makes sense.
Now, David, I know Turner Farm and Hayfield Orchards and Boone County Extension did a pruning demo. Did we already do that second class? Is that?
Yes. Okay. That's been
That'd be a great opportunity to learn, unfortunately. Yeah. We'll be doing it again next year.
Right.
There's opportunities in Campbell County for fruit pruning. If you want to, we just had a class last Friday, I believe that was. But we're going to continue working on the orchard at the Giving Fields in Campbell County. So if you need help with that or want to practice, this is an opportunity.
Someone shot us a question that they had pruned a lilac bush, I guess, and it hasn't bloomed again for several years. What happened?
These questions, I hate these questions because I don't know. I really don't think it had anything to do with the pruning, but we get questions all the time on why a certain plant doesn't bloom. Wisteria is a really common one that we, there's some drastic things that can be done to it to make it bloom. But it's something. Lilacs are really common that way too, that they really seem to be finicky about when they come in bloom. And there are people who, year after year, it's just consistent bloom. But others, for some reason, they don't. And we can go through a long list of things of why it might occur. But quite honestly, I don't think anybody has a definitive answer.
Including that, but it's also clematis as well. Yeah. Clematis is another big one. And, some of these are like heirloom plants. And if you don't even know the variety, I know there's a reblooming lilac now that we have used in our education garden, and it does rebloom, and we've never pruned it, and it stays about 3 foot height. So, yeah, sometimes we don't have answers.
Okay, you're looking uncomfortable. Why don't we move on? Fortunately, we have a question from Jess, who lives in Clifton, who can take us in a slightly different area. Jess, what's your question?
Hi. Yeah, I live in an apartment complex with a balcony that gets pretty good sunlight all day, and I'm wondering if there are any potted plants I could put out there that would attract honeybees.
Boy, any kind of good flowering plant, lantana would be one for that environment that would be spectacular. Blooms all summer long.
Herbs.
Yeah. Oh, some of the mints and some of the lavender.
I've done echinacea and bee balm. They love that. And those are perennials, so you can just keep – and I'd recommend those, since they get larger, being in 5-gallon buckets at least. But you can keep those year after year.
Yeah, lavender is a great one. They love lavender.
A lot of little blooms there.
Yeah.
Be sure that, if you travel or go out of town for the weekend, those – pots can dry out very quickly, so make sure you make arrangements to either have somebody water or set up some kind of a system where they'll be okay for a couple days.
Okay. So related to that, because talking about pots, someone sent me a question. What's the right kind of potting soil to buy. And the question was framed pre-fertilized, or should it not be pre-fertilized? Well, so
you said it right there, the right type of potting soil, and that's what we don't want people to use. We want them to use a potting mix, and it is there is a difference between that. You can buy potting soil that comes in those bags that weighs, 50 pounds, and it's sloppy and just some nasty stuff. But potting mix is usually shredded sphagnum peat moss. It'll have a wetting agent in it. There's many different kind of brands, but it's also sterile. And some of it will have fertilizer in it, which is, I think, fine. Now, if you're completely organic, this is a synthetic fertilizer that they put in there, so you would not be able to use it. But you really need to spend the money on potting mix.
That could be my mistake in asking that question. Mm-hmm. The person might have asked me about potting mix, and I just said potting soil. I'm not sure.
You'll see a big difference in price, and it's well worth spending the money on the mix.
And if you wanted to stick with an organic product, look for the OMRI certification. It's OMRI, and that lets you know that it is organically certified. So if that is important to you, that you can just look at that. It'll be right on the back.
And one question that we often get is, with container gardening and soil media that you have, you don't have to replenish that soil every year. So, every few years, probably every year you have to top dress, as you water time and time again, the soil will move. So you'll probably have to just top dress, but you don't have to remove that soil completely out of the container and then replenish with new. So just keep that in mind as well. Your first year is going to be expensive, especially if you get the containers and then that soil media or potting mix. But you don't have to do that every year.
Okay.
And if you're potting up a shallower rooted plant, you can also kind of fill the bottom of those pots with some other substrate that's a little bit less expensive. I've seen gravel, old bricks, things like that. It does make it a bit heavier, but you will save on your initial cost.
Okay. Fortunately, we have someone, Rob, who has called in and has some insight into the lilac problem. So, Rob, what can you tell us about lilacs?
Yeah, thanks for having me on. It's been my experience many plants will only bloom on new wood, which is oftentimes pruned off at the beginning of the season, later in the season, so that the plant never has a chance to set buds for next year. For lilacs, you need to prune it right after it blooms, and then that will ensure that it has flower buds for the next season.
You're dead on. Lilacs do need to be pruned, and sometimes removing some of the old canes or the old, the trunks can actually be regenerative and of real benefit, and you'll get a stronger plant.
We had a question from thank you, Rob, for calling in and at least one more suggestion about to think about lilacs. We have a question from Chelsea, who's from Hamilton. And she says, I've been wanting to grow asparagus for a number of years. I live in Hamilton, Ohio, and have mostly gravel underlining the soil as opposed to clay. So that was part of her thing. What site preparations do I need to do to allow the plants to survive and perform well? So asparagus.
One of the things that I would do is I would want to know how deep your soil is. And the first thing that I would suggest is maybe a raised bed over that area and coming up maybe 8 to 10 inches, and then filling that raised bed with some really good soil and planting your asparagus in that. And that would give you plenty of depth, and I think it would get them off to a good start. And I commend you on asparagus. I think it's a wonderful vegetable, and it's one that we really have a hard time getting people to accept and to grow. And it's incredibly easy to do it once you get the bed established. You do have to wait a year or two before you can harvest it, but by all means, it's one of the more expensive vegetables to buy. at a farmer's market or wherever. And you just can't beat it when you can go out to your yard and just cut it.
Do you think the difficulty is because of the challenges of growing asparagus, or do you think it's because of people's feelings about asparagus and eating asparagus? I'm not, you know.
It's a perennial, and it does take 2 years. And so one of the things that I always get into with people is strawberries and asparagus are the same, is weeding. And yep. You cannot let weeds, you know, run over the bed, and you've got to keep them weeded. And that is an issue.
Do you do asparagus at Turner Farm?
We do in a few of our community gardens. We're involved in the Franciscan Community Garden, which we're just there as embedded as educators, but they have a large asparagus patch. And that is always one of our work days. A large work day is the initial weeding in the springtime is very, very important. And getting that bed cleared early makes a huge difference in your production. But like Dave said, that's the biggest. I think the asparagus grows very readily, mm-hmm. But having tall weeds interacting with your asparagus and you can't find it because the weed pressure is so high, it's not for somebody who really just wants to set it and forget it. They're going to have to go out there and weed it. Asparagus being as tasty as it is, it makes you work for it a little bit.
And it's a great landscape bed, to be honest. I know, David, maybe, you know, laugh at me with these edible landscape comments, but it's a great plant to, you know, add close to the front of your yard because it can get 4 foot, 5 foot tall, and it has a beautiful foliage, almost that of looks like a fern almost. Yeah.
Berries on it.
Yeah, in the gorgeous fall, I love when it turns yellow, gold, and then the berries set. So I think aesthetically it looks beautiful, and then that's year one growth, and then year two is when you get the crop that you desire to eat. So
we had an asparagus bed as I was growing up in our backyard. We had four children, so there was no problem with weeding. Yeah. It was just a task that you had to do. And, I mean, it went on for years and years and years. Yeah. I don't know what the ultimate happened to that, but as we were growing up, we had a lot of – it was sizable enough to have some real yield off of that.
And I think, like Dave said, bringing in and making a raised bed because you're typically going to bring soil in and you're going to start with more sterile environment, so you're not going to have nearly as much weed pressure as if you were to till up a piece of your yard and try to grow it there. So I think the raised bed method really lends itself well to bringing the labor down.
There's a question here that I just can't resist, which is Peter wants to know when he can prune his rose bushes. Now, my father planted 40-plus rose bushes in our yard, and as a child, my job was weeding and then also treating because there's this dust stuff that you had to put on it. These are old. This is a long time ago. I really don't have a lot of love for roses, but Peter wants to know when he can prune his roses.
Dan, the rose is America's favorite flower.
I know, and I'm just – I was taken aback by it.
It's a tough one to grow. But right now, you are – we're coming out of the winter season, and I would begin to look at my roses, determine what's alive, what's dead, and we've had a pretty tough winter on roses. And so you're going to be maybe having to prune them back pretty heavy. And just try to take them down to where you see some live tissue. And it's not a bad time, maybe a little early, but soon I would be getting a fertilizer on them to get them jumping up to a good start. And again, I can't honestly say, Sarah, they have a sizable rose planting at the office, and you've had some issues with overwintering.
Yeah, so we have about 110, 115 different roses there. And luckily, we have a dedicated volunteer. I have learned a lot with him or from him, not with him. He's the expert, I'd say. And so, yeah, we didn't get enough mulch in this winter, and we had a harsh winter. So we lost about 7 to 10 of them that we've seen so far. And they're starting to come up. But, you know, what's really important is making sure that you heal them in November-ish time. So you heal them in and then prune them back as well. Yeah, so hopefully we don't have more winters like we've had this past year. But
well, we have a neighbor who has a rose bush that her mother had. The rose bush, and she's moved it to several houses.
Mm-hmm.
It's over 100 years old. She knows that.
Yeah.
And this comes up every spring, and just it grows taller than I am, and is beautiful. I mean, the blooms are absolutely. I mean, this one is really sturdy.
That would be a good plant to take some cuttings from and to save it to make sure.
Wonderful.
That's I hear that a lot with some of those old-fashioned roses, that how tough and durable they are, and there are some characteristics that we really need to save.
I want it sort of as a transition into gardens. I want to raise the question about composting. This is sort of a personal question of mine because I know that in a number of cities around the country, people are being encouraged to compost, partly just to keep things out of the landfills and way of managing that. What would you recommend in terms if you wanted to do composting? Now, I've had compost piles in my yard where yard waste went in and grass and leaves and that sort of thing. But I've never really taken on kitchen waste. So what would you say about that?
So composting, the most difficult for home composters is coming up with the carbon element of it. So there's pretty much two elements to compost, which is your nitrogen and your carbon. And the ratio is kind of outstanding. It needs to be, traditionally they say 30 to 25 pieces of carbon for one piece of nitrogen. So if we're talking about, say, 5 gallon buckets for an example, for 1 5-gallon bucket of food scraps, you're supposed to have 30 5 gallon buckets of leaves. And not a lot of us have that large stockpile of leaves. Now leaves is, dried leaves can be carbon, but you can find other sources. Straw works well. Help me out with some other dry sources.
Paper.
Yeah. Shredded paper works really good. And the green, the nitrogen, we consider that to be green. And that can be your fresh lawn clippings, food scraps, can be plant debris. So I just make a nice layer. So I'll dump, you know, my food scraps on, if we're starting a pile, I'll dump it on bare ground, then I'll cover it with leaves. And then the next week I'll have another bucket of food scraps. I'll dump it on top of the leaves and then cover it with leaves. And I'll make this kind of Neapolitan of compost. And then you can be as passive or as active in turning it. Some people won't turn it, but once a year, it takes a little bit longer to get things to break down. But if you want to be very active, you can turn it every other week and you'll really start to see how quickly you go through these food scraps. You'll put, you know, an apple core in there, and then if you turn it actively, you'll come back 2 weeks and that apple core is completely gone. Mm-hmm.
So what do you say about these buckets that you can – you? I don't know if you don't twirl them, but you can
– Tumblers.
Tumblers. There you go. I see them advertised.
They speed things up, but it's not – you know, composting – the rotting has been occurring for millions of years, and, you know, it's just something that's going to happen regardless, but you can speed it up by getting one of those things. It's really interesting, Dan. Most people don't consider composting until the fall of the year when, of course, we have the leaves.
Lots of leaves.
But the research shows that people throw, you know, the spring of the year, there's an awful lot of compostable material being thrown away. And that's, you know, people go in, clean up their garden beds. And there's also, don't forget, you can put sticks and twigs in a compost pile. They will break down. And all that stuff, we just don't need to be putting any of that in a landfill anymore.
Right.
So is the key to things being patient?
Yes. And with the tumblers, you know, one, they look good for your neighbors. And that's one issue that we have with composting is, you know, your neighbor doesn't want this large pile of food scraps, which is why I like the leaf covering method because it kind of hides your compost a little bit. And then I always get a lot of complaints in the community garden arena of smelly compost. And there's this connotation that compost is smelly. When it is smelly, you just need to add some more of that carbon. It's basically not getting enough oxygen, and it's rotting instead of decomposing. There's like a subtle difference there. So if you do come across a compost that's smelling, you should add in more of that carbon material, so straw or leaves, and turn it. And that'll get it some oxygen, and it should recede smelling in just a few days.
One of the best ways to get a compost pile initiated and cooking is to add some finished compost to it. And yeah. that'll really brings all the microbes and everything in there, and it'll really hasten things.
Okay. On terms of gardens, let's just start with the big question. And I'm particularly concerned about people who may have moved here in recent past. When's it safe to even start putting things in the ground? And how careful do we have to be here?
Right now, there's a lot of things that we should have already planted, although it's been tough. But a lot of your cool seasons things, onions, potatoes, those should be in the ground very shortly, if not maybe this weekend. We could be getting into the cabbage, the cauliflower, broccoli, all those kind of cool season crops. But I always say, you know, when I lived in Louisville, it was Derby Day every year. It's the first Saturday in May, and that's when I knew that it was safe to plant things outside. The tender materials, such as, you know, tomatoes, peppers, and those kinds of
spoken
things.
Spoken as a good yes. Kentuckian.
That's right. Yeah.
I grew up in northern Kentucky. Okay. So, okay. Everything is about Derby Day.
Yeah, it is. And but up here, that's not exactly the true because we've had some snows on Derby Day up here. So you really want – I think it's May 10th is really the frost-free date that we kind of shoot for.
Okay. We say Mother's Day, and that's a great day to go out and help your mom plant her garden is on Mother's Day, a good way to spend time with your mother. So I like to think of Mother's Day as the last freeze date.
I always – when we was in the garden center business, people would come in April and want to buy bedding plants, and the first question they'd say, well, are these going to be okay? And I'd always say, well, they should be, but don't worry. We'll be more than happy to sell you another set.
Okay. We're not going to pursue that too far. Emily has called in. This takes us back to composting. Emily, do you have – I'm not sure it's a question so much as a point that you wanted to make.
Yeah, I just wanted to let people know that Hamilton County Recycles has composting seminars that are about an hour long in varying communities. And you can go on their website to sign up for those, or also I think you can call in as well. So I just wanted to let people know about that. And yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much. Okay. With the question of your garden, what should be happening right now or in a week or 2 weeks when the rain stops, assuming it does? what should be the next step in terms of preparation?
So for the vegetable garden, you know, you never want to work in any type of garden, landscape or vegetable garden, when the soil is wet. So just keep that in mind.
And it is wet right now.
It's going to be wet. So just be cautious, be a little patient. And so just prepping your soil. Hopefully you received your soil sample results. So amending accordingly. If you need help with what to do, of course, there's publications. The Home and Vegetable Gardening publication is amazing. Most landscape nurseries, they should be getting in most of their perennials. They probably already have their winter annuals out. You probably already purchased those. They don't have their summer annuals out yet, so be a little patient. You could have already started some of your plants by seed. So we've actually just had some classes about seed starting. So you're a little late on some things like tomatoes.
I was going to say, is it too late?
Probably some of your vegetables like peppers and tomatoes for sure. Again, depending upon if you wanted to grow like some of your annuals flowers for cut garden or your landscape, you can start those. Just read the packet because there's a date of maturity on that. So you just want to be cautious of that. Pumpkins, for example, that are like 110 days, 90 to 110 days, you wouldn't want to do those yet. So look at that so you can calculate of when you plant those. But yeah, so getting that all ready, cleaning tools, getting all that, your tools ready, sharpened, cleaned, all that kind of stuff. But don't work in the soil when it immediately stops raining because you're going to further compact that soil.
Joshua, if we came out to Turner Farm, Would there be certain things already growing?
Yeah, so we have – well, we have the greenhouses, and most we'll kind of bypass that since most of us at home don't have greenhouses. But, yeah, we have cool weather crops out. I'm actually – I think I'm going to go
– And when did those go out? When did you put those out?
Well, we do a lot of covering, so we are a little bit more aggressive. They could have gone out as far as a month ago, but we really struggled. We had to cover things with plastic in the community gardens because the floating row cover, which is a cloth material. We got that hard freeze and that obviously that big snow last week. So things like broccoli, they got a little bit damaged because they don't like to get that frost on them. But things like cabbages, they survived just fine. So, yeah, I think right now is a great time, especially with the soil being as wet as it is. Get out and get ahead of your weeding. You're going to get the entire root of this perennial weed that's going to give you trouble all year long. But while the soil is nice and wet, use that to your advantage and get that entire root out. There's not a whole lot to be doing outside of bed prepping, but when the soil's wet, you can't bed prep. So get out and weed right now. It'll save you so much trouble. Nobody wants to weed when it's June and July and it's 95 degrees and, you know, 1,000% humidity.
Mm-hmm.
And I think from what Sarah's saying, though, you don't want to be walking around in your...
Yeah, just stick to your aisles. Don't go into the beds that you're actually planting. So you can be walking in your aisles. Just, you know, you have to wear your muck boots.
Okay. So, and then in your greenhouses,
mm-hmm.
do you start your vegetable crops in the greenhouses? Is that what you do at Turner?
So, yeah, we'll seed all of our warm, loving plants are seeded right about now. Some we still have some tomatoes already going. We have some shorter season tomatoes that are yet to plant. But, yeah, we start onions in January. So we'll start seeding those. So basically January till about mid-April, the end of April, we'll be seeding various crops all through the year, just kind of weather dependent on what they like. So our tomatoes and peppers are just now getting going. They're little seedlings by now. Mm-hmm. We'll be doing some transplanting and up-potting those into larger pots to get them acclimated. We're going to start hardening off.
In the greenhouse.
In the greenhouse, exactly.
And then would you respect the sort of May 10th deadline?
Oh, yeah. Okay. I've been burnt by that in the past, and you can lose a whole crop very quickly.
I want to thank all three of my guests today, Joshua Jones, Sarah Stoltz, and David Kester. I'm sure everyone who's listening to this knows this is my first gardening show, so they really pulled me through all of this, and I want to thank all of them. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier, assistant producer Selena Reeder, and the technical director is Josh Elstro. Archives of our programs are available on the website wvxu.org. I'm Dan Hurley.